Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his inaugural address in January, Governor Phil Scott called the state's opioid abuse crisis one of the most significant challenges we face. He went on to outline the steps he prescribes to combat it.
With enhanced treatment, better prevention, and stricter enforcement, we can continue our efforts to turn the tide. We will break down barriers, allowing models for success and lessons learned to flow freely from agency to agency and community to community. That's why I'll establish a director of drug abuse prevention, an opioid coordination council, and this year we'll convene a state convention on drug abuse prevention. This battle continues to be one of the great challenges of our time. How we react and how we choose to respond to it will be remembered long after our service is ended.
Now, the person the governor chose to lead these efforts on the coordination side was introduced the very next day. She is Jolinda LeClaire, the state's Director of Drug Prevention Policy. She joins us today, along with Vermont's Health Commissioner Mark Levine. We're going to be talking about opioid abuse. We're going to be talking about how to combat it and what the state's role in this is. Welcome to you both. What a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jane. Thank
you. Jolinda LeClaire, what exactly is your job? How would you define it?
My job is to coordinate existing resources, identify new resources, and look for best practices that we can replicate, that we can amplify, and ensure that all resources, whether it's human capital or financial capital or various programs, some of which are very complex, reach the communities and the citizens in those communities who need them the most.
Why is this a job that interests you?
Well, I have always been an orchestrator. I've spent about 30 years in the public sector. My career started with then Congressman Jeffords back in 1983. I was a caseworker. Anyone who had a problem with a federal agency or program, I worked to cut through the red tape. And efficient, effective government has always been part of my fabric. I believe the reason why government exists is to make lives better. And this was an opportunity that the governor presented to me. I, in the past, was the deputy secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets. Prior to that, I was the state director for USDA Rural Development for Vermont and New Hampshire. Prior to that, I spent 15 years with the congressman and then senator. I've worked on campaigns. I've worked on policy programs, identified where infrastructure can be better formatted in order to deliver programs to make an impact. And this seemed like an opportunity of a lifetime. As many people have stated publicly, this issue of opioid challenges, whether you want to call it a crisis or an epidemic, it is in everyone's backyard. There are no communities this does not touch. There's no geographic boundary. There's no socioeconomic boundary. There's no political boundary. And my skill set is building bridges and building collaborations. And this seemed like a perfect place for me to place my emphasis.
What have you been learning since January?
Well, I guess the question is, what have I not been learning? This has been a steep, fascinating, broad, and deep learning curve. What I've learned is that we in Vermont do a very, very good job with treatment. And in spite of challenges, whether it's Maple Leaf facility closing or it is a challenge with getting transportation to a treatment center, which we in rural Vermont certainly face consistently, the hub and spoke model, as was clearly touted by the governor, by Secretary Gobey, and by acting Director Richard Baum of the Office of National Drug Control Policy here on Monday, we do a lot right. With the opening of the St. Albans hub, we will see greatly decreased waiting lists to the point that we hope there is absolutely no waiting list. And that I have seen tremendous best practices already. In the area of prevention, what we know is that we need to amplify the messages, in particular for youth. We're talking to school principals and student assistance professionals. We're talking to the Agency of Education. We're working with the prevention staff of the Department of Health and many, many prevention consultants at each community door. How do we better educate our youth? And it isn't starting in high school. It's starting in elementary school. It's being able to talk in your homes. It's being able to talk in the hallways of your schools. It's peer-to-peer conversation. How do we better use social media to reach students today? So prevention is rising high as an area that we need to do more and better. And lastly, I'll note recovery. Recovery is something that a person with addiction does. Recovery, employment. We heard from a tremendous panel at the Opioid Coordination Council meeting the other day, and two women were talking about the importance of having a job. The employers talked about the incredible value of having employees in recovery because they are there because they want to be there. They need to feel valued and valuable. And for an employer to know that if the employer provides strong supports for the employee, they will have much, much less turnover. So we can go on and on about what are the rising needs. Important to know that there's much that is going in the right direction that is already underway.
That's Jolinda LeClaire. She's the Drug Prevention Policy Director for Vermont. And we're also talking today with Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont Health Commissioner. Dr. Levine, what would you highlight or add or push against from what Jolinda LeClaire was saying?
Nothing at all to push against from my standpoint. I'm also a member of the Opioid Coordination Council and witnessed the recent conversation that Jolinda just referred to, and it was quite powerful. I also was part of a panel presenting on prevention, and it's very quickly become apparent that we really need to put a lot of our focus on the prevention and recovery arms of our four-part mission of treatment and law enforcement, recovery, and prevention. The prevention efforts that the Department of Health is engaged in are multiple. We're working in media campaigns and with the public to educate better about the dangers of opioids, with specially targeted media messages, depending upon the age group of the audience, getting them where they're looking in terms of social media, where they're most active, working with parents on a wonderful website called Parent Up Vermont, how to have the conversations that you never thought you would have to have with your child and are almost afraid to have, but with wonderful examples of the way to engage in these conversations in a healthy manner with your children. We have, as you know, the new prescriber rules in place. We know that the prescription drug route is a major pathway to the current epidemic in heroin substance use disorder, but at the same time, it's much more complex than that. There are multiple substances that individuals can misuse on the way to that juncture. There are also multiple mental health issues that they come from, genetic influences, environmental influences early in life that lead to adverse childhood experiences and what we term toxic stresses that then lead to a self-medicating behavior to deal with the trauma of all of that. The health department's also engaged in numerous harm reduction strategies, which are in themselves preventive, involving the Most Dangerous Leftover campaign, trying to make sure that patients and the public know how to properly dispose of the medications so they don't end up in diversion which is a common pathway for those who have unfortunate substance use disorders. We have instructions regarding safe storage and disposal of pharmacies and homes. We could talk about the naloxone program, which has been very critical across our state. Over 20,000 kits disseminated to first responders, EMS, to our partner agencies that work in the substance use field, and to anyone in the public who walks into a pharmacy and would like to have access to one because a loved one may get into trouble. So I think that the emphasis on prevention is really, really strong now, and we're going to have some very concrete recommendations for the governor. In addition,
when?
By the fall, in October, actually. And the first day of treatment, in my mind, is the first day of an individual's recovery and really providing a lot more access to, resources to, and information about the recovery centers who do tremendous work in maintaining what we now know is a very chronic condition. We treat a substance use disorder like we do any other chronic medical or mental health condition because the individual has had serious problems arise from it throughout their life that don't just end the day they stop using. And they really need a lot of the behavioral and other support services, the employment support service, housing support service. And our recovery centers, of which there are 12 throughout the state, are really instrumental in helping people maintain a healthy life.
Let's go to a couple of calls. We have some listeners who want to weigh in on this. Thomas is calling in from Barton. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's a three-part question, if you will. The first one is, how do you become a patient and become involved in the methadone clinic? Referral and treatments, or excuse me, reoffending. Someone's in the clinic, they get in trouble with the law, you see them on the news. Why aren't they going off to treatment before being released back into the public? And the naloxone, I just think in safe spaces and shooting up, if you will, we're sending the wrong message to these addicts. Part of the fear is that you may die. We're taking the fear away. This is a problem.
Thomas, thanks for your call and a couple different questions there. So first, let's just talk about treatment. How does one become eligible or get into treatment? And let's start there.
So,
Dr. Levine?
So if one's already in the healthcare system, has a primary care physician, one can be referred. However, often this happens much more precipitously for the individual involved. And the individual involved can go to any of the hubs in the state of Vermont and request treatment and have an intake process that will allow them to work with the staff there to understand if methadone, as the caller pointed out, or another modality of treatment is the appropriate treatment for that individual.
Is there still a waiting list for inpatient treatment?
The waiting list was for hub treatment, which is still predominantly outpatient. But
there's also been a waiting list for centers where it's a live-in center, right?
Yes. Not within Vermont,
okay,
but out of state. But the hubs themselves, the waiting list, just in the last month since we opened the newest hub in St. Albans, has dropped below 100. And Northwest Vermont is the only part of the state that has had a waiting list. All the other parts of the state, pretty much you can get into the hub at any point in time. So I want you to know that as we further increase the patient census at the St. Albans hub, which will happen when they move into their permanent setting, it's in a temporary setting right now, we anticipate that most of the people there who actually had to travel to either Newport or Burlington to get their care will be able to get their care at that hub, opening up access for new clientele at the Burlington hub.
Jolinda LeClaire, one of the other questions that Thomas had was about why are people who are committing crimes or have been alleged to have committed a crime where there seems to be a relationship to drugs, why aren't they being required to go into treatment? And from the reporting and research we've done on this program and at VPR, it does appear that in many cases, there is diversion. And in fact, people have to get into treatment in order to either have their charges dismissed or reduced or their time reduced. What are you seeing from what you've been learning about how crime and drugs go together, but also how we're trying to treat the drug addiction within the criminal justice system?
I think there's a lot of agreement that anywhere you can provide treatment to someone with a substance use disorder possible, you do so. Whether it is pretrial services, and there are lots of excellent diversion programs underway across the state, whether it's within a correctional facility providing medically assisted treatment in prison. There are pilot programs which are testing length of time to provide medically assisted treatment across the state. And then we're also looking at when you are released from a correctional facility, how do you ensure or work to help a person stay in recovery and not relapse? One of the things that we're looking at utilizing much more than is already being in place today are peer recovery coaches. Approximately 350 Vermonters have been trained as peer recovery coaches across the state. The Vermont Association of Mental Health and Addiction Recovery provides training with support from the Vermont Department of Health. And having that human connection, someone who has been through the treatment and recovery process themselves, there's nothing more powerful than having that person connected to somebody who says, I'm ready.
Dr. Levine.
I just wanted to add that both at the Opioid Coordinating Council and in the more local parts like the Chittenden County Opioid Authority, Alliance rather, law enforcement sits side by side with everyone else. And I know from lots of experience that as long as you're not a person who's been selling tremendous quantities of these illegal substances, there's a great interest on the part of law enforcement of trying to get people into treatment as quickly as possible. And often, I should point out that the first responders are indeed law enforcement, and there's nothing more horrific to them to have to resuscitate someone from a near-death experience and then find out that there's nothing they can do but throw them in jail. They really want to get them into treatment.
Well, speaking of first responders who are now equipped almost universally, I believe, with naloxone or Narcan, Thomas says that's sending the wrong message. I know that the health department, the state government, law enforcement disagree with that. Why do you believe it's not sending the wrong message?
Yeah, I'm glad you gave me a chance to respond to that, because if there's anything that your listeners leave today with, I want them to leave with a better understanding of substance use disorder and addiction. And the fact that the individuals who are suffering from this disorder, if I may use the term, they have a hijacked brain. Their brain has been altered. Their neurobiology, the chemistry of their brain has been altered. Much of that is reversible, fortunately, with appropriate treatment, but not 100%. And this issue of a compulsiveness, an inability to function in one's life without craving the substance and without almost dedicating oneself to having the next dose of the substance is hard for those who are not in the throes of addiction to understand. So I really would like them to look with a very sympathetic mind, if you will, at the process that has occurred for the individual afflicted with a substance use disorder and realize that at the time they're overdosing, they have a singular concern, which is to get the best high they can and relieve the suffering they would have if they didn't have the drug in their system. And trying to reason with someone and create fear in them instead of having naloxone available doesn't really incorporate an understanding of this physiology and brain chemistry that I've pointed out.
Are there statistics yet, Jolinda, about whether or not having this overdose reversal drug available actually makes people more likely to overdose or not? you know, keeping in mind what Dr. Levine said, I think what Thomas, his question really points to is if you, what he's saying is if you have this reversal drug available, you know that it's there, you think that you, if you overdose, somebody's going to be able to bring you back, then you're more likely to go ahead and take that drug, even if it might cause you an overdose. Do we know statistically yet whether or not that's true?
I'm going to punt that question to Commissioner Levine on the evidence-based information that may be available. I want to underscore right now, addiction is a disease, and it's really important for us to raise public awareness, to further educate the public that this is not something that a person with addiction wants to live with for the rest of their lives. When somebody says, I am sick and tired of living with addiction, that may be the moment that whether you're an EMT or a police officer or someone in the fire department or a family member, it's that moment in time where the person is ready for treatment. To say that there is this intentional effort to re-overdose because there's an available antidote for that moment in time is an unfair statement.
I agree, and it just leads to more of the stigmatization that becomes problematic for people when they want to really begin to think about rehabilitation.
So in your mind then, Dr. Levine, does it matter whether or not it causes people to be more likely to take a drug or overdose? Is that the wrong question to be asking?
I think it's the wrong question because it really goes against understanding what's happening to that person. I would like to draw an analogy, if I could, to a longstanding societal problem, alcohol overuse.
Hold that thought, because I want to ask you more about alcohol use and other drugs. We're going to take a very quick break. Today, we're talking about opiate abuse with Jolinda LeClaire, the state's drug prevention policy director, and Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine. Dr. Levine, I interrupted you. You wanted to make an analogy with alcohol use.
Yeah, the stereotype and indeed probably the truth with alcohol use is that for many individuals, they do not acknowledge their problem with alcohol overuse for quite some time. And they may actually go on for decades, losing a job, having marriages break up, losing their family, their close relationships, and eventually they hit what we term rock bottom and then seek treatment and can do very well. The good news, if you will, with the opioid crisis is that we're dealing with often a very younger population in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and it takes a shorter time to get them to the point of treatment because it can be such a devastating both health, mental health, and otherwise part of their life experience that they will get to treatment sooner. The unfortunate part is it's estimated that 8 to 9 out of 10 individuals who are currently having a severe opioid use disorder do not seek treatment. So while we talk about our waiting lists and the access to our hubs and our spokes, the problem is actually how do we find the individuals who are not even engaging in the process of trying to access treatment?
Let's go to Anne calling in from Bristol. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I am very interested in this discussion. I'm a retired social worker now, but worked for years and years at the Addison County Parent Child Center with young families, and we were all very, very aware of and worked with a lot of families who were dealing with addiction issues. And the thing that really intrigues me, I don't hear it talked about very much, is because the whole nation, you know, seems to be acknowledging that there's this huge opiate crisis. What is it in our culture that is seeing such a great rise in addiction? And statistics may show, oh, it's only more, you know, evident, or it used to be alcohol and now it's opioids and all of the attendant things. But one of the things that's ironic to me is that when people are get good treatment, which you guys have talked about beautifully, that it's so much about creating community and creating places where people can go to, you know, feel useful, have a job, be supported, have real community. And in fact, I think that that's what's needed on the prevention side. And I think it brings in issues of poverty and marginalization and all the things that we faced every day at the Parent-Child Center. And creating community is one of the most powerful ways. When you talk about prevention, you talk about being able to talk with our kids about drugs more. Well, that's important, but I don't think that's nearly as important as providing, obviously I'm biased, really good childcare and places for kids to feel like they belong and have things to do and have a future and all of those kinds of things. So I'd just be interested in your comments about all that.
Anne, thanks for your call. Jolinda LeClaire?
Thank you. Well, I'm going to start with where you left off. Community-based initiatives, community programs, community engagement is absolutely critical for everyone, whether you're a young person or whether you're a senior citizen. We know that activity is key to feeling connected and engaged in life. There are three programs I'll note across the state right now, the first which the governor highlighted in his executive order, which created both my position and the Opioid Coordination Council back during his State of the State address on January 5th. And that is Project Vision, which is a cross-sector public-private nonprofit and community member partnership based in Rutland, looking at all the challenges as well as the pathways forward to help people feel engaged. It's everything from looking at community housing and transportation and employment and community centers where people can feel like they just can have a meal or a conversation. And I think one of the things we talk a lot about when we talk about the role of primary care physicians is that conversation between a doctor and a patient. It can be a conversation between any adult figure and a child where they're focusing on what is positive in life. I also think you brought up in the beginning the why, and we do need to look at why do we seem to have a greater problem today than we did many years ago. Hard to know whether that's actually true. I think the role of media, the access to information has helped to rise the tremendous challenges that we see today. We also know that there are opportunities and pathways for change.
Rick emailed in to say there needs to be much better education and prevention efforts given to and delivered by the right people, not researchers, pharmaceutical companies, policy leaders, or heads of large hospitals or clinics, but by first responders, frontline clinicians, people in recovery, both medication-free and successfully using medications. And my wish as a healthcare provider and student of addiction research and treatment is that all of these deaths will lead to the transformation of how we as a society cope with physical and emotional pain and suffering. Catherine in Troy, New York says drug addiction is primarily a physical condition. The addict has almost no control at all without help, as is the case with most physical ailments. Scott in Springfield, though, brings in another component and asks what causes people to get into using besides the initial doctor-prescribed painkiller. If you don't address the emotional and spiritual components, you'll never win. Joshua in Rutland says, in my opinion, the only way to stop opioid abuse is to stop making opioids. Of course, that's never going to happen. It's a problem that will always exist, and we can only put a Band-Aid on it. Well, let's talk a little bit about prescribing and what role doctors play in this. Patty Fisher is Medical Director for Case Management and Medical Staff Affairs at UVM Medical Center, and she's on the line with us now. Hello, Dr. Fisher. Nice of you to be here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that UVM has been doing is looking at and monitoring prescribing. And statistics from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, showed using records from a couple of years back, that Vermont was really an outlier in the number of prescriptions and pills for opiates that were being distributed. And UVM is, of course, the largest health network in the state. And so I think we can assume that a large part of that came from UVM prescribers. As I said, you've now been tracking prescriptions, and recent data that you've put out shows that prescriptions are down. So what have you been doing to try to get a handle on this?
Oh, we've been doing lots of education about the problems with opioids. We've had some internal folks that have been doing studies about prescriptions, so how many prescriptions are patients getting after surgery, how many prescriptions are people getting from dentists, from oral surgeons, from the ED, and really looking at then how many pills people are actually needing or using for those acute events. And we're discovering that we could prescribe a lot less and still treat people acutely for surgical procedures and for fractures and things like that that people actually do require some opiates for.
So when you talk about or think about how prescribers play a role in what's being called the opiate epidemic, how do you frame it? How do you think about it?
I think prescribers have not had a lot of education, and the education we had back in the 90s was poor education. It was, you know, you were going to get sued if you didn't treat pain adequately, and pain became the fifth vital sign, and there was a lot of pressure to treat people's pain and give people a pill for whatever ailed them. And the pressure came from regulatory agencies and from communities and patients sitting in your office. And it has been there's been a lot of pressure to prescribe. And it takes a much longer conversation with someone in your office to say no and say, why not? And what are the risks of these medications? But I think it's become clear that these medications are very dangerous, that they are diverted, that they are abused, that they are misused, and that we need to think about them very differently and much smarter.
There's been some pushback from doctors and others in the medical community to the new prescriber guidelines that came out of legislation passed this year in the state. What do you think about these guidelines that limit prescriptions and at first prescription? The idea is not to say this is how many pills somebody can have and you can't go over, but really to try to limit initial prescriptions and to make sure that there are checks and balances for other prescriptions going forward. What do you think about it?
Dr. Chen, the commissioner at the time, actually did a great job of including many physicians in the process. So there were many of us at the medical center and from other healthcare facilities around the state that were all involved in helping Dr. Chen write the rules. Our surgeons played a large part in trying to figure out what is the right number for someone of pills for someone to have having shoulder surgery, for instance. And so the acute pain prescribing rules were actually created quite collaboratively, and quite a few of our docs had input into that, and we're continuing to also give them kind of feedback on the rules and as we're using it, and do the acute pain section of the rule make sense? Does shoulder surgery actually require more opiates than what we had initially thought when Dr. Chen wrote the rule? And, you know, Dr. Levine has actually been great in taking some feedback from us. And as we continue to get data, we're continuing to give it back to Dr. Levine and to the state. And, you know, like with any change, there's going to be pushback, and there are people that are still not as informed as others as to the risks of these medications. And I think it's good practice. It's what we should have been doing all along.
Let's go to Carl calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Carl. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Oh, this is Carl in Wethersfield, I believe. Hi, Carl. Is this you?
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on?
You're on.
Okay. I'm facing bilateral hip replacement September 12th. And at this point right now, I can barely walk, and the pain is pretty good. It's pretty bad. But my surgeon and my primary are very afraid of prescribing anything other than tramadol, and it's really not as effective as it needs to be. And so I just want you to know that they're working with you, but it's having an effect. I have 2 months to go just about, and I'm not looking forward to this time, and I don't know what to do about it. I understand that the terrible fix we're all in, but I don't know what else to do.
Yeah. Carl, you know, your experience really brings something up because, Dr. Fisher, we hear this from patients whenever we talk about ways to get a handle on prescribing, that patients who have pain, whether it's acute short-term pain or chronic pain, really fear that their treatment and their ability to live a pain-free life is going to be impaired because of prescriber guidelines or prescriber fear. And here's Carl saying, you know, I have a surgery coming up. I'm worried about what my doctor says I can have or not have. How do you balance the needs of patients?
It is tough. So people like Carl are in no, you know, unquestionably he has pain, and we need to figure out a way to manage his pain. The thing I would also say to someone like Carl is, so your surgery is 2 months away, but do you know that if you take opiates for more than a week, you are at 13% risk of becoming dependent on these opiates a year later? Do you know that if you take opiates for more than a month in this initial episode, that you are going to be 30% chance that you're going to be on opiates a year later? So that's the question, that's the thing to pose to people is, I understand you're in pain, and I understand that these medications help somewhat, but we also have to think about the long-term adverse effects of these. Do you really want to be stuck on these medications in a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or whatever it is? Because there are lots of people out there now that are on, that are physically dependent on these medications because they were initially prescribed for some acute episode such as this. So what else can we do to manage his pain? Is he taking scheduled Tylenol? Is he taking scheduled ibuprofen? I'll tell you, our orthopedic surgeons now at the medical center for knee replacements, they're not using any opiates. They have a high-dose Tylenol regimen that they are discharging people without any opiates after knee replacement surgery, which is astounding to me, that you can actually use other things that are not going to create a potentially lifelong dependency.
That's Patty Fisher. She's Medical Director for Case Management and Medical Staff Affairs at UVM Medical Center. Patty, we could talk to you all day. Thank you very much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're talking about opiate abuse today, the situation in Vermont, as well as prevention and treatment. This is a wide-ranging conversation and certainly one that we've been having on this show, we've been having as a state for many years now. Lots of movement, also lots of angst, lots of anguish as people continue to be addicted to opiates, continue to see this reverberate in their communities. We're talking with Jolinda LeClaire, the state's Drug Prevention Policy Director, and Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont's Health Commissioner. And let's go to Adam, calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Adam. Your thoughts.
Hi, yes. Thank you. The Commissioner, I just wanted to say the Commissioner is totally correct when he says that opiate-addicted people, don't realize it. All they're thinking about is getting that next high, say. And myself, I've been clean for 10 years. I'm on the Butte program, and I have four boys now. And when I had my first boy, I decided, you know, I made some mistakes when I was younger, and I decided that I was going to turn my life around. And if it wasn't for the programs in Vermont that were established, and they're getting better now, I wouldn't have my children. I wouldn't have my family and my friends. And for the law enforcement to say that to make you scared is going to help, it's not. When I was doing what I was doing, there was nothing else on my mind. Being scared wouldn't it have mattered. So the naloxone and the Narcan, to be out there to help them, is the best thing there could be, because it's not going to slow down. And the way that the state's going now is amazing. The programs are awesome. And for me, it was the best thing that ever happened in my life.
Adam, boy, it's really wonderful to hear your story and wonderful to hear that you've been in recovery for 10 years and really are celebrating this life you have with your children. Thank you very much for sharing your story and for calling in to telling us about it. Adam mentioned the Butte program. That's buprenorphine. It's one of the medically assisted therapies for opiate addicts. And also mentioned naloxone. That's something we talked about earlier. It's the overdose treatment that's carried by many first responders and others, family members, friends of addicts, that can help reverse an overdose when it's happening and in many cases prevent death. We got a note from Amber in Hinesburg who says, Thank you for doing this. Your guests are on point. We need to educate the public about what opiate addiction is and what it does to folks. For those of us who are loved ones of addicts, it can be painful and hurtful to read comments saying that those people don't deserve to live. I hate that people don't understand it, and I'm afraid that many more people will die and suffer before this ends. It's terrifying and sad. Educate. Paul says, I've been in the field of addictions for many years in a number of capacities. A couple things I've seen over the years are a lack of common language between prevention, intervention, treatment, and recovery. How people talk about the issue is very different depending on the perspective they hold. Another issue is the fact that those who seek to address the problem of addiction need to also address it as a symptom. And that's something that our guests today have been talking about, that this is a health issue. You know, we are talking about people. We mentioned at the beginning of the show 12 overdoses just in Brattleboro on July 4th and 5th. One of those people has since died. You know, this is something that the state and medical professionals and families and communities are really trying to get a handle on, but it is still something that's killing people and harming families and harming communities. And Jolinda LeClaire, as you sit in this role as drug prevention policy director and you're trying to look at this from a statewide level, what do you think we still need to be doing better? Or, you know, where do we need to focus our efforts so that we are making sure that this is a problem that perhaps we'll never completely solve, but we can actually get a handle on and help the people who need and want help?
I see a multifaceted approach. One is that across state government departments and agencies, we need to better utilize the resources that we have today, meld them, and make sure that they are reaching the people and communities needed the most. We have a lot that is going right with these programs, but there's a nexus and an efficiency and an effectiveness that we can amplify. This morning, I saw on the news a human chain from a beach out into the water where there were 9 people who were caught in a riptide off the coast of Florida. And I say this, even this is my last 30 seconds I can use, because it is about a human chain. It's about a partnership where we hold hands and we figure out how to best improve what already exists. We've talked about a lot that's going in the right direction. We also know that with prevention, we need to amplify messaging. We need to reach students where they are, whether it is in their home, whether it is in their schools. We also need to ensure that there is appropriate recovery housing, employment, jobs for people who are in recovery, supporting the employers who are employing people in recovery, making sure that people in rural communities across the state, and it is one of the most rural states in the nation, even though we are very small, that we have access and we can reach the tremendous services that do exist. And finally, I want to go back to something Commissioner Levine said, is that helping people talk, reducing stigma. We know we need to reduce demand. Law enforcement will constantly work to reduce supply. But we need to make it safe for people to talk about their experiences, tell their stories, and support each other.
Got 20 more seconds, Dr. Levine. I want to give you a chance to wrap up, too.
I just wanted to pick up on Adam's comments. He's maintaining himself in a recovery community. He's in our spoke system because he's not only getting prescriptions for buprenorphine, but he's connected with a whole host of social and other support services that are instrumental in him maintaining his recovery. And I'd like to just add on to Dr. Fisher's comments that the best aspect of the new prescriber rules is the conversations it generates between clinicians and patients. And make sure that all of your listeners engage in those conversations and look at the alternative forms of treatment for the pain that they're experiencing and discuss, frankly, the strength, duration, and number of pills that might be prescribed if they get an opioid so they don't have leftovers that could be susceptible to diversion.
Have a conversation with your doctor. That's Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont Health Commissioner, and Jolinda LeClaire, Vermont's Drug Prevention Policy Director. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.